Please be seated.
Thank you.
I now call Mr. De Pelsmaker. Do you confirm that your full name is Tom Willie De Pelsmaker?
Yes, I confirm.
And you are the team leader, freshwater and land at the Otago Regional Council?
That's correct.
And you've prepared a statement of evidence in chief dated 7 December 2020?
Correct.
And a statement of evidence in reply dated 19 February 2021?
Correct.
And you've set out your qualifications and experience at paragraphs 3 through to 7 of your evidence in chief?
I have, yeah.
Now, are there any corrections you wish to make to either of your statements of evidence?
Yes, I would like to make a few corrections. Yeah.
If you could just step through those.
Absolutely. In a number of paragraphs, three paragraphs, I have made reference to the number of catchments in Otago. Mm-hmm. That's in paragraph 33, mm-hmm. 69, and 78. I just want to clarify that that figure refers to the number of catchments that have water takes on them or in them. The actual number of catchments in Otago is much bigger than that, but it depends on the way you classify them, I guess, as to how many there are, and that's more a question for a hydrologist, really.
So the point of clarification for paragraph 33 and also 69 and 78 is that where you say 140 catchments, you are talking about catchments in relation to which there are existing permits to take water.
That is correct.
But there are more catchments than
yes.
that.
Yes.
Yep. Okay. Yeah. Okie dokie.
Are there any other corrections?
Yes. Also, on paragraph 51D of my evidence in chief, I refer to the term evapotranspiration. That should be evaporation. That's on paragraph 51. Mm-hmm. Paragraph 49. I state this network has large gaps with many of the region's ephemeral water bodies, and I would like to add to that are also water bodies with drying river reaches that are not sufficiently monitored. I think that's an important point because those are one of our most challenging rivers, really, in terms of doing hydrological and ecological assessments.
So I'm amending, I think it's line 1, 2, 3, 4, amending line 4, which commences bodies and then inserting bodies and also water bodies with drying reaches.
Yes, correct.
And then it goes on, not yep. being monitored. All right. Okay.
On paragraph 108B, the replacement of deemed permits, including deemed permits for the I would like to add the taking, discharge, and then it goes on damming of water.
So can you read that first line of subparagraph B? So it reads
yes.
the replacement.
The replacement of deemed permits, mm-hmm. including deemed permits for the taking, discharge, and damming of water, and water permits to take and use surface and groundwater connected to surface water, where those water permits expire prior to 31st of December 2025.
Okay.
Then in paragraph 136, on the third line, I make reference to clause 4B, whereas that should be 4A. And further down in that paragraph, I have a sentence starting following clause 3 and clause 4A. Again, should add A. As stated, the paragraph only refers to clause 4. Then on paragraph 238, I make reference to the 31st of December 2023, and that should be the 31st of December 2035.
So second to last line on page 72 that should read December 2025.
Yep.
2025 or 2035?
2035, yeah. Sorry.
35. Okay.
Yeah. Footnote 10, which is footnote 10 in my evidence in chief on page 13, that can be struck out because it is superseded by my evidence in reply, where I acknowledge that there are deem permits that authorize the discharge of water. Mm-hmm. And then the final correction in my evidence in chief is on paragraph 472. And there I make reference to, right at the bottom of the paragraph, policy 10A23B. That should actually make reference to RMA section 104D1B.
So read the last sentence. I think it's the last sentence. Is it the last sentence you're talking about or the sentence before? On paragraph 472?
Yeah, this is intentional as policy 10A23A sets the threshold required to be met under section 104D1B of the RMA.
D, I'm missing?
104D.
Oh, D, okay, yeah.
1B.
All right.
And then in my evidence in reply, I've got two corrections. Mm-hmm. On paragraph 82, D. Currently, the paragraph reads, the amendments to policy 6.4 set out the matters for consideration. It should make reference to policy 6.4.19. It's paragraph 82, subparagraph D. So it should make reference to policy 6.4.19. And then a minor typo on paragraph 187. On the third line, I state the needs of existing water users, and that should be existing water users.
Thank you. And subject to those corrections, do you confirm that your evidence is true and correct to the best of your knowledge and ability?
I do, yeah.
You could please... you've prepared now a summary of each of... a summary with respect to the evidence you've produced. If
yes.
you can read that summary out, we'll just hand a copy around.
Yeah. Thank you.
In your hands. Yeah.
I might bring it back right to the purpose of Plan Change 7. Mm-hmm. Purpose of Plan Change 7 is to establish an interim planning framework for the cost-effective and efficient assessment of resource consent applications for the replacement of deemed permits and water permits for the taking and use of fresh water, while ORC is developing a long-term NPSFM-compliant planning regime for the management of land and water in its region. This interim planning regime must ensure that the transition towards the long-term planning regime can occur in an efficient and timely manner by providing strong policy direction on consent duration for applications to replace existing deemed permits and water permits expiring prior to 31st of December 2025, as well as applications for new water takes. Plan Change 7, as notified, initially proposed a two-tiered consenting pathway by which applicants can apply for resource consent to replace an existing deemed permit or a water permit expiring before the 31st of December 2025, either as a controlled activity or, where they cannot meet the controlled activity conditions, as a non-complying activity. I note that in response to submitter comments and concerns raised by experts, I have recommended a third pathway, where applicants who cannot meet some of the entry conditions of the controlled activity rule can apply for a short-term consent as a restricted discretionary activity. Plan Change 7 further enables the transition to a long-term sustainable management regime by reducing the risk of further environmental degradation through a number of mechanisms, which are avoiding the reallocation of paper allocation or unused allocation, limiting the quantity of water allocated in resource consents for the replacement of existing water permits, including deemed permits, to the quantity of water that has been used in the past. A requirement to carry over minimum flow, residual flow, or take cessation conditions on existing consents as consent conditions on any consents that replace those water permits. And also, finally, by discouraging further investment in irrigation expansion until a new NPSFN-compliant planning framework has been introduced. The need for the plan change stems from a number of interlinked resource management issues. First of all, historically high levels of water taking in parts of the region, and an allocation framework in the operative water plan that does not prioritize the health and well-being of water bodies and freshwater ecosystems. Secondly, inadequacy of other aspects of the planning framework in the water plan in terms of giving effect to the objectives and the policies of the NPSFM. Thirdly, a lack of understanding about our region's freshwater resources and the effect of water abstraction on those resources. Uncertainty around the planning framework, including the outcomes and the limits that will be established in accordance with the NPSFM and the National Objectives Framework, in the new freshwater planning framework that is to be notified in December 2023. And then finally, the expiry of a large number of water permits and the growing demand for water prior to the new freshwater planning framework becoming operative by the 31st of December 2025. The plan change has generated a large number of submissions, some of which were in support and others were opposing the plan change or requesting amendments. Key concerns raised by submitters are the social and economic impacts of only providing for short-term consent durations, plan change provisions force a clawback on actual water use through how Schedule 10A4 operates. The plan change does not achieve good environmental outcomes or outcomes that are not as good as what the current water plan would do. The plan change fails to provide for a cost-effective process. The use of the controlled activity pathway needs to be further encouraged, while stronger and more certain thresholds need to be determined for granting consents under the non-complying activity pathway. Exempting specific activities such as damming, hydroelectricity generation, and community water supplies from the framework of Plan Change 7. And the plan change does not give effect to higher order planning documents and is inconsistent with a water plan. In my evidence in chief and evidence in reply, I have recommended a number of amendments to reduce the impacts of the plan change on water users that have recently undertaken or committed to investment in irrigation infrastructure, reduce the risk of a clawback on actual water use, and improve the ability of existing consent holders to apply for consent under the controlled activity rule. I acknowledge that the plan change does not give full effect to the NPSFM 2020. However, I consider that the plan change with the proposed amendments goes some way to meeting various requirements set out in the NPSFM while enabling an efficient and timely transition towards a long-term NPSFM-compliant freshwater planning regime. So in my opinion, in doing so, the plan change actually achieves the purpose of the RMA. I am mindful that the amendments that I have recommended do not alleviate all the concerns expressed by submitters. As I have previously stated in my evidence in chief and evidence in reply, I am open to further exploring, either through considering the expert evidence provided by submitters during the hearing or through expert conferencing, how the plan change provisions can be further refined to better achieve the plan change's intended outcome. In my opinion, there are four areas where further amendments could be considered. The first one is to make the controlled activity pathway more appealing without, however, creating a risk of further environmental degradation. Secondly, strengthening the non-complying activity pathway. Thirdly, make better provision within the framework of PC7 for higher priority takes and uses that provide for the health needs of people, recognizing again PC7's intent to ensure that those activities will be carried out in accordance with the NPSFM compliant management framework of the new land and water plan within the lifespan of the plan. And then finally, amend Schedule 10A4 to better align the rate of take and volume limits determined under the schedule with historic water use, recognizing the schedule's intent to provide for a cost-effective and an objective method to calculate those limits. Now we've got a final paragraph, but I think that can be struck out because it is superseded by the evidence that Mr. Leslie produced.
Thank you, Mr. De Pelsmaker. If you could remain for any questions from the court, from my friends.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I just have a few sort of high-level questions to try and orient myself a little in terms of the water plan and the local situation. I guess the only exposure I had to those things was being on the Lindis minimum flow and the primary allocation and the resource consent case with Judge Jackson and Commissioner Borthwick, which wound up towards the middle of last year. So just to get myself a little bit oriented, we have Schedule 2A.
Correct.
Which in the plan here somewhere.
Yes.
Okay. And I note that some of the parties are suggesting that the Schedule 2A minimum flows. I'm going to have trouble finding my own Schedule 2A at the moment. Page 363, thank you very much, Mr. Page. Oh, I see, I've got volume 1 and I need volume 2. Sorry about that. Sorry, what was that again? 361, was it? 363. Oh, 363, sorry. Yeah. Thank you. And you've got 363 there, or that part of the plan, Schedule 2A?
I don't have the plan with me, or the schedule, but I'm quite familiar with it, so.
Thank you.
So just looking at these various catchments that have got these minimum flows, is there a plan, some sort of spatial representation of what's covered? In terms of these minimum flows, which water courses we're talking about, which water bodies?
Yeah, we currently do not have within the plan a map that shows how those minimum flows are distributed, because I guess that's what you're referring to, like basically a
yes.
map of all the catchments.
Yes, I didn't find one in the plan, but I thought you might have one somewhere.
We have produced one and a couple of years ago, and I'm sure we can produce one fairly quickly for you. Yeah.
And so all these minimum flows were... Presumably, they came into the Schedule 2A at different times?
That is correct. A number of these minimum flows were introduced with the plan. And over the years, since the plan was made operative, we have undertaken a number of plan changes to introduce new catchments into the schedule. The last one is the Lindis, although that's still going in process. Pomahaka, Waiwera, I think the Tairi at Te Ruiti as well, were all minimum flows that were introduced subsequent. Lugget Creek is another one. Wainakarua. Yeah. So it's a mix. Sorry.
Well, I guess my next question was going to be in terms of the numbers of permits that there are in these water bodies that are subject to the minimum flows. Does the Regional Council have a database on which ones are subject to the minimum flow in terms of consent conditions?
That can be fairly quickly produced, yeah. We have done it, but it's worthwhile updating, yeah.
So... can you give me some sort of indication of what that might look like in terms of the percentages, for example, or of consents, or the, and I suppose relating to the instantaneous take volumes as well, perhaps.
In terms of your question as to how many consents have minimum flow conditions on them within those Schedule 2A catchments. Some more than others. I'm reluctant to kind of make any definitive statements around that. Like I said, a while ago, I looked at the numbers. For example, I think from memory, the Pomahaka has, I think, over half of the consents there have minimum flows on them. In others, like the Manahurkia of the Tari, from recollection, it's a much smaller number.
So I was just trying to get some sort of gauge on how many people in the tent, if you like, in terms of the minimum flow requirement, and how many people were outside the tent.
Yeah. It's very hard to tell you right now, but like I said before, we're happy to look into that and provide you with a an overview of, or a table, so to speak, of Schedule 2A catchments with the number of consents and the number of consents that have minimum flows, Schedule 2A minimum flows on them. I think that can be done. Yep.
And in relation to the ones that we're largely dealing with here,
the
deemed permits and the ones that are going to run out shortly and need renewing and those sort of things, is it possible to get a gauge on whether any of those have minimum flow conditions?
The issue with deemed permits, and that is especially relevant, I think, for the Manahurkia, is Manahurkia has a lot of deemed permits, and deemed permits do not have any conditions to protect environmental values. So they would not have a minimum flow on them. It is only a replacement consent for those deemed permits that would get a minimum flow as a consent condition on them.
So that's deemed permits, but the other categories?
Being resource consents.
Yes.
They would be in a minority in the Manahurkia catchment as, in terms of volume and also numerical. When I say refer to volume, the volume of water taking, the majority of the water would be taken under deemed permits. They would not have a minimum flow on them as a condition of deemed permit. Some of the resource consents in the Manahurkia might have minimum flows on them. I am aware that some of them have supplementary minimum flows. So, some will have a minimum flow. As the question is whether it's a primary or supplementary. I cannot give you a definite answer to that.
And so can you just expand a little on that a little bit for me in terms of the primary and supplementary allocation and the consent? How's that relevant to what we might be dealing with? Or is it not relevant?
It is relevant. Let's bring it back to basics. We've got in our current water plan, we've got a system that distinguishes between primary allocation and supplementary allocation. In one catchment, we've got another type of allocation, but I won't go into that because it will make it too complex. Primary allocation is basically allocation that gives you the highest surety of supply. It's typically taken by run-of-the-river water takes, although some of the deemed permits that provide for damming, they take water all the time, and then they actually do like water harvesting. They take run-of-the-river takes, but also high water flows. But primary allocation is the most reliable water. The Schedule 2A has minimum flows in them, and those Schedule 2A minimum flows apply to all primary allocation takes. So that can be resource consents within primary allocation or deemed permits, because we also consider deemed permits to be part of that primary allocation. So primary allocation is really like a bucket of water that comprises the quantity of water taken by those primary allocation consents and deemed permits. We've also got a second type of allocation, and that's supplementary allocation. And that allocation is granted in resource consents when there is no further primary allocation available. So in that case, we will allocate water at higher flows. So those consents will be subject to a minimum flow higher than the primary allocation minimum flow in Schedule 2A. Those minimum flows are set in Schedule 2B. Those supplementary allocation takes are typically used for water harvesting at higher flows or for snowmaking as well, because they take in winter when the flows are higher as well. So those are basically the two types of allocation under the current water plan. I think both are relevant in terms of Plan Change 7, because through Plan Change 7 and subsequently through the new land and water plan, what we're trying to do is deal with the primary allocation and kind of come up with a sustainable allocation framework for primary allocation. That will have an impact on the bucket of water in primary allocation that is available to resource consents. Now, supplementary allocation, the level at which we can allocate resource consents within supplementary allocation is kind of reliant on or is determined by the bucket of primary allocation. To give an example, if we manage to limit the primary allocation, we might be able to grant supplementary allocation at lower flows. What we're trying to do currently is to avoid competition between the two.
Just say that again. I missed the first part of that. Can you start that sentence again or that paragraph again?
Yeah. So what we're trying to do in managing water is to try to avoid competition between the two takes. So we try to avoid that supplementary allocation takes try to encroach on the water that is available to primary allocation users. So that's under the current plan. Therefore, we set the limits, the minimum flow limits for supplementary allocation really high. If you manage to reduce the volume in primary allocation, you might have an opportunity to make supplementary water more accessible, bearing in mind that in the new land and water plan, we also need to look after the values in the river as well.
So coming back to PC7,
yes.
The relevance of
yes.
So to PC7?
PC7 captures not only primary but also supplementary allocation takes. We also want to make sure that we don't lock in long-term timeframes for applications for supplementary allocation, because that again, that framework for supplementary allocation will be affected by the plan review, and it might look totally different under the new land and water plan.
So just going to paragraph 4 of your evidence.
Yes.
Where you talk about the requirement to carry over minimum flow, residual flow, or take cessation conditions on existing consents.
So, sorry, were you saying paragraph 4?
Paragraph 4C. It's on your page. I don't think these pages are numbered.
Sorry. Yes.
So I just wanted to know if you had a database or anything that listed out things that were subject consents that were subject to residual flow or take cessation conditions. I asked you, I know, about minimum flows before. But I guess that that was in relation to the Schedule 2A.
Yeah. I do not operate or administer the database. That would be possibly something that would be in the consents database. And I have to refer that question to Mr. Leslie, perhaps, or somebody from the consents team. Like I said before, I have...
So you've taken advice from them?
I have taken advice from them. And we asked to generate a table that looks at all the Schedule 2A catchments, how many consents, how many have a minimum flow on them. But I would, before I hand anything to the court, I would like to have this updated and verified.
Right. So but that's the minimum flow, but you've also mentioned residual flow or take cessation conditions.
Yes. I'm not quite sure whether we have in the database or whether we can abstract from the database an overview of all the consents that currently have a residual flow condition on them or take cessation condition.
I guess I was just trying to understand what's the scale of what might be involved with that and where does it relate to?
Yeah. Residual flows condition in the last couple of years have been regularly applied to resource consents. Minimum flows, we in the plan, we have a policy that basically states that where we have a minimum flow in the plan for a catchment that has deemed permits, we do not immediately put those minimum flows as a consent condition on those on consents in those catchments. We will only do that unless the consent holders volunteer that or upon the expiry of deemed permits in 2021. The reason why we're doing that is because we cannot impose those conditions on deemed permits unless we give financial compensation. And also, minimum flows, the way they work, they don't really work unless all the consents in the catchment adhere to them. If you have some consents in a catchment with a minimum flow, if some of those consents have a minimum flow condition and others don't, there is still a risk that rivers will be drawn below the minimum flow because those consents that don't have the minimum flow as a consent condition, they can keep on taking when the minimum flow is reached. I also want to add that a minimum flow does not prevent the river from going below it naturally as well. But you really need to have all the consents, or the majority of the consents at least, within a catchment adhering to a minimum flow before it actually works.
So there may be some information.
There may be some information.
And you need check that out with the consent people. So we have a number of competing propositions in terms of PC7, if I could put it that way. And I'm just a little puzzled by a couple of things, and I thought that you might give me your take on them. So we have a proposition, I think, Mrs. Dicey's evidence. I don't know whether You might have that there. It's page 78. You have that there now? Such a lot of paper.
Oh, yes. I was looking at Ms. Dicey's summary in the main body of her evidence, but yes.
Page 78. And I'm just looking down 12.1.2, the permitted activities that she's proposing. And then if you go down to 3... where we have any existing requirement, condition or priority status applying to the exercise of a permit under this rule shall continue to be legally binding. Now, I just wondered if you could help me with understanding, with your understanding of any existing requirement, condition or priority status. Perhaps we could start with the priority status. Mm-hmm. What would you understand by that?
So that goes back to the deemed permits, and I think I have, I will summarise it, but I might actually have a summary in what the priority status means in my evidence. I think I explain it in paragraph 3. Priority status, when the deemed permits were issued, they were given a priority, and the deemed permit or the mining privilege.
The old mining privilege
that was first issued got the highest priority. Subsequent mining privileges had lower priorities, and that was basically to protect the rights or the access to water for the holder of the mining privilege that was issued first. Those priorities are still on the mining privileges or the deemed permits stated. They're still stated on there. I am not quite sure to which extent they are currently being exercised. They are actually not conditions to a mining privilege or a deemed permit. So my understanding is that council cannot enforce these. It is a matter between consent holders as to whether that structure or that priority system is being adhered to. It might be that water users within a catchment have rationing regimes or flow sharing regimes that are different and that that are currently in place. So, but that's what the priority refers to, basically. If it would be applicable, I think Ms. Dicey's intention would be to preserve this status.
And how might you do that, then, if you're suggesting this is all outside of the...
It would be very difficult to do. We currently do not have a policy in the plan that would support something like that, or the setting of conditions. I guess you could make – you could impose consent conditions on new resource consents to replace deemed permits that basically establish a flow regime that mimics those priorities. But I would assume that would only apply where all the consents or the consent holders in the catchment come in at the same time for a new resource consent and agree to that as well.
So you don't see priority as having anything to do with your primary and secondary allocation?
No, nothing to do with that.
You see it in terms of the mining privileges. And are there any existing requirements or conditions that you can think of other than the ones that you've mentioned in terms of residual flows and cessation?
Some resource consents have conditions on them that they should cease water taking when other consents are being exercised. So that could be an example of a flow cessation condition where you're required to stop taking when another consent in the catchment is taking. It might be often it's the consents held by the same person.
Yes, I think I'm aware of some examples of those. Yes. So just coming back now to the DOC planner's evidence. Appendix 1, I think it is. So that's the evidence of Murray Brass. So do you have that there?
Yes, I have. Yes.
So on page 2 of Appendix 1, the submission refers to apply banding or some other suitable flow trigger to retain existing deemed permit priorities. And then what we have recommended by Mr. Brass is some new clauses for that. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted your opinion on these clauses, what you would understand by them and how you would see them being implemented.
I fully understand where Mr. Brass is coming from, and I acknowledge the need, I guess, to protect in-stream values. Mr. Brass, however, has also acknowledged in his evidence that it would be a complex and a fairly difficult thing to establish coming up with some kind of a flow regime between different consents. It would be something that would involve cooperation of different consent holders. And then there is a risk that it kind of detracts from one of the intents of the plan change, which is to provide for a quick and a cost-effective and an easy process. So in a way, it would make, especially when we put it on the controlled activity rule, it would make the controlled activity rule quite complex. So that's one thought, quite expensive, perhaps. The other thing is, the way the schedule works as well, to some degree, might actually help to address that concern. The schedule tries to estimate how much water is being taken on an instantaneous rate of take basis, but also in terms of volumes daily, monthly, yearly. So what the schedule does is it tries to kind of come up with allocation limits that reflect the current pattern of taking. Not 100%, don't get me wrong, but it will prevent that people with a lower priority status will all of a sudden ramp up their taking, either instantaneously or in volumes. So the schedule might go some way in kind of preserving the order between the different deemed permit holders. As I said before, you also, before you establish that, you also want to make sure that the priorities are actually still adhered to. Because if that isn't the case, you upset the flow regime. And I think there's a number of experts that have already, Mr. Alabone, Dr. Alabone was one of them, that already have indicated, like, we need to be careful as well. More water is usually good, but not always. In some cases, the current situation might actually help to sustain certain pockets of migratory galaxies. I'm not saying that this is a good solution long term, but remember, this is a very short-term plan change. It will be superseded by the new land and water plan, which is to be notified, or the provisions will be superseded by the new land and water plan, which will be notified by the end of 2023. So,
yeah, so you're not a fan of what's proposed, but I was trying to understand how you might work out what previous deemed permit priorities were and how you might or might not be able to easily do that or objectively ascertain what they are.
We can easily get them because they are stated on the deemed permit. So the deemed permits are, we have the deemed permits at the ORC, and the priorities between the different deemed permits are stated on them. So that's not difficult. The difficulty is being sure whether those systems are actually observed by the deemed permit holders, because we don't enforce priorities.
Okay, so I don't know whether we've got an example of a couple of deemed permits that might illustrate what you're referring to. We may have in the evidence.
I think we have deemed permits which illustrate the licensing regime which has been carried over, but I think the witness is saying they don't know whether individuals have exercised those rights as
correct
between themselves and other permit holders. And I guess the question there arising, well, if they have, is that on a continuous basis, or was it, you know, just for a season, perhaps, you know, in a dry year? So I think is what your evidence is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, I think I can leave that at that point. Thank you. So just moving down my list, I'm nearly at the bottom of it. But what I'd like to have a look at now is the evidence for the planner for MFE.
Yes.
In terms of their suggestion on the controlled activity. So I'm looking at page 33. So do you have page 33?
I do.
So the MFE witness has crossed out items B to I, and now what's suggested as a suitable substitute is matters covered by the conditions of the existing deemed permit or water permit being replaced. And I wanted your opinion as to what you think that might cover, whether perhaps we could start by saying, do you think that would be broad enough to cover all the items that you had under B to I?
It is probably too broad. In a way, I can... Again, Mr. Ensor has a very valid concern. What he's trying to do is... He wants to make the controlled activity rule more appealing, more attractive. The concern that I have with this particular proposal is that one of the key principles behind the plan change, or two key principles behind the plan change, is to avoid any further degradation and also to make sure that we do not reallocate paper water, and that we actually bring the allocation and the new consent in line with historic use. I'm a bit concerned that this recommended amendment would allow people to take more water and better utilize their existing allocation. And in a way that would be losing, I mean, the point of this plan change is to hold the line. And I'm a bit concerned that we're not quite holding the line. But again, he's got, you know, the intention behind it, I am supportive of that, which is to make sure that people, instead of going for the non-complying rule, get attracted to the controlled activity rule.
Okay. So the next thing I wanted to ask you about was your restricted discretionary proposition. Well, an aspect of it. So if you could just find your page 61, I think that will be attached to your reply evidence. So I'm looking at B2. Well, actually, I think you've got B1, but it's really B2, where it's demonstrated in the application that, and I guess I'm thinking, well, this is a threshold requirement for qualifying as a restricted discretionary activity. It's an entry point, so should be objectively ascertainable what it is you need to meet in order to be a restricted discretionary activity. And I'm looking at your number 3, the environmental effects resulting from the use of irrigation will be reduced.
Sorry, Commissioner, which subparagraph are you on? This is,
Page 61B, yeah. And then it's got 1-1, but actually the second one should be 2, and then it's number 3 coming down. So the first one's about buying infrastructure, the second one's about a more efficient use of water, and the third one's about the environmental effects. Mm-hmm. Do you have that?
Yep.
So I guess I just wanted to explore a little more how you would see this actually working.
Yeah.
Because there's reductions and reductions, isn't there? There's no sort of scale on this, so...
Mm. I guess...
it could be a minimal reduction.
It would rely on an assessment by an expert that demonstrates that the expansion, which in many cases will be provided through a change in the irrigation infrastructure, that it has an overall net benefit on the environment. That could be either through runoff, avoiding runoff, or that there is sufficient buffering between the irrigated area put in place compared to what previously there was, from sufficient buffering from nearby water bodies. Yeah, it has to be done on a case by case basis, I believe.
So early on you talked about having a net benefit approach, so you're taking the environmental effects in the round. Is that what you meant? And then you went on to talk about individual environmental effects.
Sorry.
Well, you mentioned individual environmental effects like buffering, for example. But before that, you talked about a net benefit. So
yeah.
I was trying to understand what you understood by this. So it's quite a broad concept.
It is a broad concept. I think with irrigation expansion, if it constitutes a change from traditional, say, less efficient irrigation to more efficient irrigation systems, there are some potential benefits and there are some potential risks. Like I said before, potential benefits could be a reduction in runoff, which has a benefit in terms of you reduce E. coli levels potentially in affected water bodies. But a risk is, and that is, I think the evidence of Dr. Olson kind of states that there is still a risk that there is increased nitrogen input as well from irrigation. So, all those different risks and benefits need to be considered, I guess, within the application and adequately addressed.
Risks and benefits. Risks, you said. What was that? All those potential...
Well, yeah, you have to do... I would assume that whoever prepares the application looks at it in a comprehensive manner. You don't pick and choose and you say, well, it's going to reduce the risk of runoff without looking at the potential for nitrogen leaching as well.
Mm.
So... The intention behind the rule is really, the broader intent behind the rule is that people that have started exploring irrigation expansion before the plan change was notified or before we started talking about it, they will want to maximize that. And because they cannot currently apply under the controlled activity rule, well, they can, but then they lose that investment, they would be tempted to apply for a longer-term consent under the non-complying rule for 15 years.
Well, I think we understand where this is coming from. Probably don't yet understand what level of what is meant by environmental effects, much less how would you know or predict those with any confidence by 2035, so it's only a 15-year period. You've got an associated policy, yes, you do, because you've amended 10A 2.1. So, and the policy is increase in irrigation area will result in a more efficient use of water, but also the environmental effects resulting from the use of irrigation will be reduced. Well, how would you test that? And is the language, is that appropriate language?
There is probably an opportunity to sharpen it up. I will acknowledge that. I had a very limited time to go through all the evidence submitted and provide evidence in reply. So if there would be any concerns around the wording of that, I am happy to come up with alternative wording.
So I guess I'm just looking at two.
Yes.
You mentioned before holding the line was the phrase you used.
Yeah.
But increasing the area under irrigation, is that holding the line?
That is why we have specifically subparagraph 3 in there to make sure that the increase does not risk us to cause ground or lose ground.
Okay, well, I've come to the end of my list.
Oh, I haven't started.
It's nearly 5 o'clock. So.
I've got questions as well, so I'm just going to hold you over on your oath, and that's pretty straightforward. It just means that you're not to talk to Mr. Moore or any other council party or any other witness, but you can talk to your kids.
Sorry, excuse me?
You can talk to your kids, to your partner. So, just try and refrain from discussing the case with anybody who's got an interest in the outcome or interested generally. All right? And we'll see you back here at 9:30.
Thank you.
Okay. Just one question here, if I may.
So,
you seem to have two requirements under that, where there's not a complete set of data.
Sorry.
This is under this one that Commissioner Regents has just been talking to you about, this restricted discretionary.
Yes.
In under A3, it says where a complete set of data is not available. Is that?
So the rule basically tries to provide for two circumstances.
Yes.
Where people cannot.
So it's either or, is it?
It's either or.
Okay.
So for people that don't have a complete data set that that is required under Schedule 10A4, and for people that have started. Or commissioned an expansion in irrigation infrastructure.
So it's either or?
Either or,
okay,
yes.
That clarifies for me. Thank you. Thank you, Your Honour.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. Okay. So we're adjourned through to 9:30 tomorrow morning. Right. Anything, Mr. Page, you're on your feet.
Just briefly, ma'am, Commissioner, you were looking for a map of the minimum flow areas in the plan. It's Appendix B to the regional plan. It's not reproduced in your common bundle, but is available online.
Appendix A. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Page.
We'll have you at the stand next. Thank you. Not that I was suggesting he was giving evidence, but he knows the plan very well. Thank you. All right.
All rise.